Hi, I'm Samson Mo, Chief Strategy Officer here at Blockstream, and this week I will be hosting Blockstream Talk. So my guest is none other than your usual host, Jesse Knudsen, our VP of Financial Products. In this episode, we're going to dive into Jesse's background as he comes from the banking industry, and we talk about his early days as a Bitcoiner in a bank. We also talk a lot about the Blockstream mining note, which Jesse is the primary driver for here at Blockstream. So he deals with Stoker, our partner in Luxembourg, to do all the tranches. He handles the investor relations and also is very active in the community talking about the BMN. We also talk about his newsletter, which he's been writing for a very long time, which gives a lot of insights into the Bitcoin markets. And we wrap things up discussing his vision of building financial products on top of the Liquid network. I hope you enjoy this episode as much as I enjoyed recording it. Hello, and welcome to a new episode of Blockstream Talk. This week, or this episode, I will be your host. So the interviewee has now become the interviewer. How do you like that, Jesse?
The tables have turned. I don't know. We'll see.
We'll see.
So far, so good.
So why don't we start by giving your introduction, who you are, what you've been doing, and your background, and your role at Blockstream.
Sure. My name is Jesse Knudsen. I'm VP of Financial Products here at Blockstream, and I'm working on building out a portfolio of financial-type products. The big one at the moment is the Blockstream mining note. Previous to working at Blockstream, my experience was mostly in investment banks, first as a sales trader, and then later in equity capital markets. And I've also worked really closely with the mining team here at Blockstream to help leverage some of those relationships from my previous career and introduce them into our mining business. And I mostly host a podcast. Sometimes I'm a guest.
Right. So you are a banker by trade. How did you get into Bitcoin and what was your journey like? And were there things that you had to unlearn to become a Bitcoiner from banker?
Yeah, I think for my generation of people in banking, the global financial crisis, the GFC of 2008 was kind of a really, really big moment. And I think that probably was a big moment for Satoshi as well, right? I mean, if you look at the text in the Genesis block and, Chancellor on brink of bailout for the banks, I think it's probably fair to say that that was a big motivator for Satoshi. And I think Bitcoin itself was probably in some ways a response to the GFC. So post GFC, I was sitting on a trading desk at Barclays in Taiwan with my colleagues, and we were just constantly looking at the trajectory of markets, our careers, the industry, and everything that the world was on, and just thinking, how does this not absolutely end in tears? And around that time, I stumbled upon an interview with Raoul Paul and Grant Williams talking about Bitcoin. And I'd heard about Bitcoin previously through talks from Andreas Antonopoulos, and it sounded kind of interesting, but Raoul framed it in a way that I think, given my background, made a lot of sense. And he also had a $1 million target price on it. So that was really interesting. I thought, I better take a look at this and figure this out. It seems like, there's a lot of people talking about this. I should probably try and understand it. And that's what I did. And I mean, Raoul had the $1 million target price, but he later sold at $2,000. So that was kind of funny. But I think for guys like myself that realize that there was a problem in markets and in the world in general, and I think especially for more macro-first focused investors and even a lot of gold bugs that acknowledge that there's this problem that needs to be fixed, it wasn't much of a jump to go to Bitcoin. There wasn't anything to unlearn because you already thought that there was a problem. And when you dig into Bitcoin, it just seems like, hey, this could be a plausible solution to this problem.
Well, hopefully you stopped following Raoul Paul's advice, right?
Yeah, he's gone out into the weeds a little bit. I do. I'm still a subscriber to Real Vision, and I do like listening to his commentary on some stuff. But yeah, he's definitely gone out into the weeds a little bit.
Yeah. So you mentioned some years ago you tried to get your colleagues, your fellow bankers, into Bitcoin, and they didn't react that well. So how did things change? Are they coming to you now and saying we should have listened to you, Jesse? You were right all along. Or what is the dynamic like, and what are those conversations like?
I don't think that ever happens. People never come back and say, I should have listened to you. But You know, I loved working at Macquarie. And one of the cool things about being at Macquarie is they've got a stretch of quarterly profitability that goes back something like 40 or 50 years. So they're very entrepreneurial, and they very much encourage you, if you have a good idea, to shoot it upstairs and try and advocate for that idea and to try and push it. So in 2016, I started to think that Bitcoin was probably my good idea. And I started to push it internally. I think people look back at Bitcoin's history, and I think we think about the last 4 or 5 weeks in 2017 as really crazy when price went parabolic. But people forget that 2016 was a pretty crazy year too. I mean, that was just a constant, every day we were up 80 bips. It was just, we were going up almost every day. And then periodically we'd have like a 30 or 40% drop, but it was up almost every day. So that was 2016, I think, was a really interesting year. So my first idea that I pushed internally was, hey, we should do a Bitcoin fund. I was looking at the GBTC and I thought, well, this isn't a very effective tracker fund. This could be improved upon. So why don't we try and take our resources as a bank and repackage this and do something similar, but make it a better tracker fund. And the feedback I got on that wasn't very positive. So there was a lot of pushback. Like, Bitcoin was seen as very speculative, very risky, and not really great for the bank from a reputational perspective. But as it continued to go higher, I mean, I was lucky to have a very supportive boss and who was helpful at connecting me into people. And we ended up forming a digital asset working group with people in different geographies in Macquarie, in Australia, in the US. And I was a key part of that. So we got to do a lot of interesting things that eventually culminated in us putting $5 million into Bitfury. And that happened in 2018. So I think that didn't really get a lot of press, but I think for the time was very, very forward looking for a bank to do. We also got to do, I got to do a lot of investor kind of relations events and just basically got put on the road to talk to all our hedge fund clients and gauge their level of understanding in Bitcoin and what their interest was. Like, would they actually be interested if we could do a product? And that was a really interesting time because it was kind of mid 2017 and Bitcoin, you know, was kind of gaining steam, but hadn't had the blow off top yet. And I was getting meetings, like normally I would get a meeting with, you know, two or three kind of people at a fund, but I was getting meetings where 19 people would turn out and it would be, you know, the whole investment team. It would be traders and it would be portfolio managers and senior CIOs. So that was really interesting. That's when I started to realize, okay, there is a massive amount of institutional interest in this thing. And we also got to do a lot of really good, investor relation events. So we had, I'm based in Taiwan. So we had a dinner in Taiwan for some senior management clients. And then we had Charlie Lee and Bobby Lee and Vitalik all at the same table. And that was an interesting time too, because that was like July of 17 when ICOs were just starting to get going. And I had just learned about ICOs like that week. And so we got to ask Vitalik about it. And I was like, wait, this is, people are giving people money to do what? You know, and it was just kind of really interesting and exciting time in the space. And then later that year, we also had a really big institutional conference at the same time that people like JP Morgan were doing these blockchain events. We wanted to do one that was very much a Bitcoin event. And that's when I met you, Samson, as I DM'd you on Twitter and said, hey, you know, I work at this bank and we want to do a Bitcoin event. Would you come and talk to our clients? And you said, hey, I can't make it, but we got this guy, Adam Back. Yeah. I said, oh, okay, yeah, Dr. Back, we'd be interested in hosting him. Adam came, and then we had JL, the CEO of Tether and Bitfinex, and we had senior guys from Bitfury. So, you know, looking back, it was a really unique opportunity for those investors. And we had 80 or 90 institutional investors at our offices in Hong Kong. And they got to interact with, some of these people who were really heavy hitters in the industry and ask them questions. And I think that was a really exciting time.
Yeah, definitely. I think some people forget, but back then, Bitcoin was a dirty word. And that's why I think a lot of the narrative was circled around a blockchain. You know, you talk about the blockchain, you don't talk about the Bitcoin because, you know, that's kind of sensitive. You don't want to get into that topic, right? But that was an interesting era. It was like a formative era of Bitcoin where you had to kind of like sneakily talk about Bitcoin without talking about Bitcoin.
Yeah, I had people tell me that they would not put their names next to a Bitcoin project. There was just too much reputational risk personally and then for the bank as well. And so I think we've really, really turned the corner on that with all the institutional investment we've seen over the last 12 or 15 months. I think that's basically in the past now. And there is no reputational risk now for banks to participate in Bitcoin. And that's a big change.
Yeah, we've come a long way. The other thing is, you're kind of outlining a missed opportunity for Macquarie. Macquarie could have been like a GBTC, right? They could have done that years ago.
Realistically, like, you can only do what you can do, and they probably couldn't have got away with that. And it was probably, in hindsight, it was, you know, probably a bit naive of me as the loudest internal Bitcoin nut to propose that as a first project. But it did eventually go in a good direction. And you know, some of the people from our digital asset working group also went off to work in the space. So two of the key constituents were the guys that went up and set up Iris Energy, which is a miner IPOing on, I think they've already IPO'd on the NASDAQ. So, you know, I think the banks probably have lost a lot of brain power too, to Bitcoin, to the industry, because it just pulled people out.
And I guess that's a good segue to get into mining, because, you know, you helped get Macquarie actually into mining now. So let's talk a bit about mining at Blockstream and the BMN. So it's been great to see an accelerated interest in the BMN. Maybe you can give us an introduction of what the BMN is, how it works, what are tranches, and like, why does Adam Back need to market buy Bitcoin every time we do a tranche?
Yeah. So Blockstream obviously has a fairly large mining business, and the BMN is basically our effort to tokenize that business, which has been predominantly institutional focused, right? And to offer our mining business, that product, to a broader range of investors, whether they're family offices or individuals. At the moment, the BMN is only open to non-US investors, qualified investors, but we're working on broadening that to US investors as well. It's not as easy as it sounds, and I understand there's a lot of demand in the US, but it's a work in progress, so I appreciate the patience of the people that are waiting on that. Each node is backed by 2,000 terahash, plus or minus, and the Bitcoin, and what investors get is the Bitcoin that underlying hash rate produces over the course of 36 months. And what you're referring to with Adam having to buy Bitcoin in the market is that's to maintain fungibility. So if you think about it, we're issuing these tranches over multiple time periods. So the first one was done in April, and those investors have mined almost 2 Bitcoin in the 120 plus days since then. So if we do a tranche next week, we have to make sure, for fungibility, to make sure that the tranche coming up has the same amount of Bitcoin. So you have to go into the market, buy 1.9 Bitcoin, and tie that to the new BMNs that are being issued. And so that's important for fungibility and to make sure that it's all apples to apples. And then when we get this thing trading on exchanges, that there'll be better liquidity rather than having, you know, BMN Series 1 tranche A, B, C all the way through.
Right. So you're saying that the BMN is backed by Terahash. How does that differ from, you know, cloud mining or just leasing machinery from someone else?
Yeah. So that's part of the reason why we have to do it in tranches, and why we just kind of, our target is obviously 100 million euro. We go back and forth between euro and US dollars because it's issued by a Luxembourg securitization fund. So most investors are probably more familiar with USD, but we do go flip back and forth between euro and USD, which is slightly annoying. That's why we have to do multiple tranches, is because we have a pipeline of equipment coming in. I think everybody's very aware of the global semiconductor crunch and how it's very difficult to get hardware. So we can't just issue 100 million BMN and then hope the equipment comes in. I think that's how a lot of cloud miners blew themselves up. And I think they probably, not all of them necessarily, had nefarious intentions when they started. They just got caught up in being unable to meet obligations that they were already committed to. So to prevent that kind of situation, we're only issuing BMN when we actually received hardware, have it installed, and are beginning to mine. So I think that's a very big difference to cloud mining. And then the duration too. I mean, 36 months, you can buy hash rate contracts in the market, but there's nothing even close to that duration, 36 months. I think the longest hash rate contracts that I've seen are 6 months. So it's really a very different beast in terms of products that are currently on the market. And then I guess also that it's an STO issued by a Luxembourg securitization fund. You know, it's a lot more transparent. There's offering documents. We're applying for an ISIN. It's just a different level of transparency and kind of obligations on our end that I think should give investors a bit more of a peace of mind.
And there's liquidity, right? You can trade it right away, OTC, and it's coming out on Bitfinex Securities
Yeah, that's amazing. I'm actually quite amazed to see how we've had a organic peer-to-peer market develop in the Telegram chat. I mean, to traditional investors, the idea that this thing is trading in a Telegram chat probably sounds a little bit insane. But it's a really cool community, and people are in that. I would definitely recommend taking a look at that Telegram chat, reaching out to us and getting the link, because people are doing a lot of modeling in there on Bitcoin mining that I think is pretty top notch. And it's a pretty good source, I think, for information in general. And then people are trading the BMN back and forth with each other. Of course, between whitelisted individuals, it is a security token, so you have to have a whitelist. The goal ultimately is to have it trading on a lot more exchanges. And Bitfinex Securities will be the first step on that, but we hope to have more in the future.
Yeah. Link to the Telegram group is right here. So Tranche 6 was the largest BMN tranche to date at 13.9 million euros or $16.1 million. And there's a lot of institutional investors coming in. What's your take on the future of the BMN and where it's going?
Yeah, so I think the participant mix, the investor mix, is changing a lot. So the first few tranches were heavily skewed towards high net worth Bitcoin type investors. But I think now we're having a lot more conversations with more traditional investors. So I think that's one direction it's going. I think especially as it gets bigger, we'll see a lot more interest and participation from more traditional investors. It's really an interesting product. I think the STO industry is an industry that's been waiting for a product to kind of like push it forward. And I think the BMN might be it because it's a natively Bitcoin product. And I think it's one that traditional investors are very interested in, right? Like clearly mining has a lot of investment interest at the moment, given the premium the miners are trading at. We're also working with custodial partners to help custody both the BMN and the Bitcoin that's produced by the BMN. I think that'll be a big step to being able to integrate and interact with some of these bigger professional investors. And I think we'll see more support from trading venues as we go forward. So there's really no reason why the BMN can't trade on a national exchange, like a proper traditional markets exchange in some place like Europe or Asia. I think that's definitely, that could happen.
Or maybe Seychelles.
Exactly right. Yeah. I mean, I'm in Taiwan, right? So I have had conversations with people here about having it listed in Taiwan. And it would be a big jump for them. The regulators here are very conservative, but I don't think it's impossible.
You write the Blockstream Markets weekly newsletter, which is great. And I want to continue on that line of thought about institutional investors. But in your newsletter, you said that Paul Tudor Jones kind of kicked off the institutional phase of Bitcoin adoption. And I wanted you to expand a bit on that and what it means. And also, I believe he said something about self-custody, and that is the best way to hedge against inflation. So maybe give us some of your thoughts on these.
Yeah, I think when he had that investor letter that came out, I guess it was fourth quarter or third quarter of last year, I think that gave a lot of, institutional investors are not that dissimilar from retail investors, really. I mean, they're very herdish. And they look to see what their peers are doing. And a name like Tudor, when Paul Tudor Jones wrote that in the investor letter, that he thought Bitcoin was the, probably the inflation hedge, I think that caught a lot of people's attention. So that helped really kick off the streak of institutional investment that we've seen over the last 12 or 16 months. And I think there's something there. Like the inflation, the traditional investors are definitely investing on basically a pure inflation thesis. And that's something that I brought up a couple of times on other podcasts that we've done. What are they missing, right? So Paul Tudor Jones, they're looking at Bitcoin as a pure inflation hedge and with a high beta kicker. That's kind of how I describe it because he calls it the fastest horse, right? But he says it's got the characteristics of gold, but it's much smaller, right? And there's, like we discussed yesterday, there's an ocean of institutional money that's trying to fit in a very small container, and that will just drive price higher. So I think that's what he means by that. But I think he's right. Like Bitcoin is definitely the inflation asset. And a lot of that is like there's Tinder that has built up over generations. And COVID was this spark that got a fire going that accelerated all of these trends that are really massively beneficial to Bitcoin and would have played out anyway, but COVID and government response to COVID and all the money printing and kind of, like authoritarian kind of responses have really accelerated these trends in Bitcoin's favor. And I think the Lightning Network is probably something that these investors haven't quite factored into their models yet. So if you think back kind of in 2016, 2017, the narrative for Bitcoin kind of went from peer-to-peer electronic cash to store of value and to digital gold. And I think what's going on in El Salvador is shifting the focus back to electronic cash. So I think that application is not at all on the institutional radar. And I think that that could be massively disruptive and also big for Bitcoin in terms of network effects as well, and could push prices beyond what they're probably anticipating. And then I think also improved confidentiality and the ability to move value out of jurisdictions, jurisdictions that impose ideas like unrealized capital gains. I think that will become increasingly valuable in the future. And I don't think investors have necessarily factored that into their thinking at all.
Yeah, I think the electronic cash narrative or aspect of Bitcoin is really about the bearer aspect of it, right? And I think that's why PTJ is saying, you know, you need to hold your own keys. It needs to be in your own custody. But, you know, you can't have eCash without value, right? It can be a medium of exchange, but unless it has value, it's not going to be a good medium of exchange.
Yeah, I think, you know, his point was kind of, he was being asked about, what do you think about this futures-backed ETF? And obviously, it's not an ideal instrument, right? It doesn't track that great. It's not like a spot ETF. There's a lot of additional costs on it. And it's just easier if you can just to buy Bitcoin. Why not buy the real thing and then have all the benefits like you mentioned of, you know, a bearer asset? The problem is that for a lot of institutional investors in the US in particular, is that there's regulatory and mandate restrictions, and they just can't get access to it. You know, if you're a fund, you can't necessarily buy Bitcoin and self-custody it. But, you know, that this is one of the interesting things about Bitcoin, is that we as retail investors, as individuals, have that freedom, and we have a big leg up on the institutional guys who will eventually go that way. It's just going to take them years.
Okay, let's shift gears a bit and talk a bit about Blockstream's acquisition of Adamant Capital. So what was the goal to acquire that hedge fund, and what kind of products are we trying to build on Bitcoin and on Liquid?
Yeah, I think the Blockstream mining note is I look at it as like a massive icebreaker, right? That's just kind of, it's plowing the way for a lot of other things to come. It's a very unique product. As I mentioned, it's natively Bitcoin. And I think it really bridges the gap between the old world and the new world. And I think it's something that traditional investors really want to invest in as well. I think the BMN will be a big part of driving broader Liquid adoption and a slew of new assets and products that will be issued on Liquid. So in the Bitcoin space, there's some really interesting yield generation opportunities and some traditional arbitrage strategies that work really, really well in this space. So I think what we're trying to do with the fund is to build on the momentum of the BMN and the broader Liquid adoption that we're seeing, and package up some of those strategies and offer them to investors in kind of a pretty convenient way. So I think the most exciting version of the strategies that we're looking to put into the fund are, if you can, you know, do it on Liquid, if you can marry it to a token, if you can self-custody it, and if you could trade it either P2P or on something like Bitfinex Securities. And I think that becomes really exciting. That's probably the best version, I think, of what we're doing, and probably our the end goal for where we're trying to get to.
Definitely. So you were one of the early Bitcoin adopters at Macquarie. Maybe you can talk a bit about how we established a relationship with Macquarie at Blockstream to do mining. Why did they decide to work with Blockstream, and where we're going in that direction?
Yeah. I think, you know, a firm like Macquarie, they obviously do a lot of due diligence on anyone they're going to work with, especially, you know, if it's in the public eye. So, and they're, maybe for US listeners, they might not realize the scope of Macquarie, because they're not, you know, a big retail bank, but they are literally in the infrastructure space. They are the whale of whales. They have the world's largest infrastructure fund. And so they have a lot of partners globally that they can select from. So there was quite a rigorous selection process that we had to go through. And I think it's a big credit both to the mining team and to Blockstream in general that Macquarie chose us to work with. So I think we should be extremely proud of that. And Macquarie they're nimble. I think they're the tip of the spear, probably relative to kind of their counterparts in the US. So I think there's going to be a lot more very well capitalized players entering the mining space in the coming years. including sovereign states, right? So I know that you've, you know, we've talked about this before, but there's a lot of noise coming out of Central and South America. There's sovereign states that are investing in mining there. Last week, there was news that Laos in Asia expected to make $200 million next year from Bitcoin mining. So the space is changing very, very quickly. And I think while it's great to be chosen by people like Macquarie, that we also need to be very front foot, and we need to be moving forward and chasing down opportunities to make sure that we don't get passed by some of these guys who are going to be very, very well capitalized and pushing very aggressively to expand in the space. So that's a challenge for us.
Yeah. It's funny how you mentioned that, like, some people in the US are not that familiar with Macquarie. When that announcement first came out, I didn't hear that much from, you know, my friends on this side of the world, but all the friends I have in Asia and Australia, they pinged me right away and they said, that's huge, that's massive, I can't believe you got Macquarie, you know? It's just, there's a bit of an information divide here.
Yeah.
But, you know, if you have a good grasp of, you know, everything around the world, who are the big players, then you kind of see that this is where it's going. It's going towards Bitcoin. Everything is going towards Bitcoin.
Yeah.
And Bitcoin mining and financial services built on top of Bitcoin.
Yeah. And Bitcoin mining is a great one for those kind of investors, because it's not, you know, it doesn't have all the issues of trading and messing around with fiat and all of those kind of regulatory hassles that come with that. Mining is an infrastructure. It's a yield business, right? It's something that they're very familiar with. It's like running a waste treatment plant or something like that, right? Where you do a big infrastructure build and then you earn back money over time. So that's something that those kind of players are very familiar with. And it's not that big of a leap for them.
I think we're also very lucky at Blockstream to have you, because you were the key man on that deal, bringing it in and getting it put together.
Well, that's why I get paid the big bucks, right?
That's right. That's why you get paid the big stats.
That's right. Just, try and do my part.
Yeah. So you've been writing this Blockstream Markets Weekly newsletter since you started.
Yeah.
Let's talk about that for a bit. What is the goal behind it? And, you know, is it a lot of work to do? And does it consume a lot of time? And do you get any good feedback from people saying, you know, that's a great newsletter?
No, not really. Oh, no. So it's, you know, so I was a sales trader for years, right? And that's a big part of the job, is every day you write market wraps. And I'm in the habit of doing that. And I think I would do it even if I didn't send it out, just because it helps me organize my thoughts and keep on top of what's going on. And that way, you know, when I have a call with someone about the BMN or about Bitcoin or the market in general, that, you know, that I have thoughts that are up to date and I have a view on the market and hopefully can add value in some way. The newsletter is something, it might be one of the longest running newsletters that nobody has ever heard about, right? So I started writing it at Macquarie because it was just decided internally that we needed to have something like that. Like, we needed to be up to date on the news and the price and stuff like that if we were going to try and push Bitcoin internally to senior management. So that's kind of when I started working on it. So it's probably been going for, 4 or 5 years running. It's just an effort to organize trading, news, and market trends. And, you know, occasionally take a stab at where I think price is going. It is a ton of effort to write that, but I think it's useful, and it helps me, and hopefully it helps, you know, people looking at the Bitcoin space as well. Definitely sign up.
Yeah, definitely. And I think we can put a link. If we can't, then cut this part out.
Yeah.
Yeah, I remember when you first started writing the Markets Weekly, and I think you had a little piece of technical analysis there, like a flag analysis, and yeah. Adam commented and said, you shouldn't include TA in this thing, but it was just a funny funny argument that I witnessed.
Yeah, no, I'm a pattern guy. Like, I like a lot of those basic patterns, and I think that they work very well in Bitcoin. So I think things like the pennants, the flags, I think Bitcoin is actually a very technical asset. And I think, you know, having worked in Taiwan so long, where Taiwan markets are massively retail dominated, right? Like 70% of the trading volume here is retail. So, and because Bitcoin historically has been retail dominated, I think there's a lot of spillover there. And the things that work in markets like Taiwan and Korea, where there's so much retail participation, tend to work in Bitcoin as well. So that's something that I've noticed. And people have different perspective on how they read the tea leaves, which essentially is what it is, right? So that's, I do like the pattern stuff. I've toned that down a little bit. I know Adam doesn't like it, so I've toned that down a little bit. But I do like the statistical stuff too. Is a lot of fun. And do reference a lot of the on-chain stuff, though. I do have some, you know, kind of question marks there on how accurate that stuff is at times.
I don't know. For me, none of that really matters. It's just going to keep going up. It'll just go up at varying rates.
Yeah, I mean, I typically have an optimistic kind of bullish bias, and people make fun of me for that in the note, but it, you know, I've been right, right? We're still going up. So that you do have to have that in the, you do have to have that in the back of your mind in Bitcoin, that this is an asset that is still small, that has a lot of upside. The macro trends are all in its favor. There's very little institutional investment that has to grow. You have the demographic things in its favor. I think everything points to it going bigger. So I think you have to have that in mind when you're looking at your timing. You know, I think it makes sense just from a trading perspective to have your long-term HODL position and then have a discretionary trading position where you flip in and out. And yeah, I think tactically, like on the pullbacks, buying the dip, right? It works out. It makes sense.
Definitely. So looking forward, what are you most excited about in the world of Bitcoin?
Yeah, I mean, I think the world has changed a lot in the last 2 or 3 years. Generally, I think the overall trajectory is not great. But, you know, that's what got me into Bitcoin. And I think that broad-based acceptance of hard, censorship-resistant money can go a long way to fixing the world's problems. So that's kind of what motivates me to be in the industry. And that's what I look forward to seeing, you know, Bitcoin's contribution to the world in general. So I think it's that, and then 100,000 price print by Christmas would be nice as well.
So basically, your outlook is Bitcoin fixes this.
Yeah, pretty much. I think for a lot of things. Yeah, I mean, inflation is a massive problem, and it has been for a long time. And that's one of those things where I feel like I've been talking to people about that, to investors, for a long time, and they've largely dismissed it, right? So I can remember a conversation with an analyst in 2018 where I was talking about inflation and how, you know, it's a big problem for people on the street. And I don't care what the Fed says, it's a problem. And he says, well, you know, CPI is low. And I said, well, my kid's tuition goes up every year. Houses are only going in one direction. Like, there is clearly inflation. And he said, well, I don't know what to say. CPI is just low. So, you know, inflation is a big problem. And I think Bitcoin goes a long way to fixing that, for sure.
Definitely. Well, it's been a great chat, Jesse.
Yeah.
And I'll give the show back to you next week.
Great. Thanks. I thought I was going to have to look for another job there.
All right. Thanks, and talk next time.
Thanks a lot, Samson.
Thank you. Bye.
Great. Bye. I hope you enjoyed this episode of Blockstream Talk. If you want to support the show, feel free to leave a review, like, subscribe, and share. It really helps us get on the right side of the social media algos. And follow us at Blockstream Talk on Twitter. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you in a couple of weeks.